In Hebrew, the term hefker describes unclaimed property, an object which has been lost and for which no owner has put in his bid. In rabbinic Hebrew, by extension, a generic term evolved called hefkerut, which was used to denote a condition of aimlessness, of confused ideas, of a way of life in a community where there was no clear organizing principle. Since the emergence of our liberal Jewish tradition nearly two centuries ago now, Jews of more traditional bent have tended to claim that, to put us down with the term hefkerut, to claim that we are not only burdened or possessed, built around a core of loose ideas, aimless confusions, there's no fixed standard intellectually or halachically to what we do, but also to add to this put down, this charge, the assumption that since presumably we lack a set of central ideas, of standards, direction, limits, our character must show the same kind of wishy-washiness, of confusion, and of aimlessness. Now, knowing our own character and knowing the quality of our homes and the concerns of our synagogues, we've not been much put off by the charge of hefkerut when it was raised by those outside the gates. But in recent years, a number within our own community have been wondering aloud whether or not there is still some organizing principle, some basic authority, a set of standards around which the liberal Jewish tradition has organized itself, or whether we are guilty of hefkerut, of trying to be all things to all people, and in the consequence really being nothing clear to anyone. Now, as always in the history of ideas, these concerns tend to erupt around what are relatively narrow and parochial issues. The issues of war and peace, of race, of social concern are so broad and involve so many entities, so many groups of power, so many sets of ideas that it's very hard to focus all of the issues, and therefore movements rarely need to define themselves clearly against them. But when the shoe pinches, when there's a very clear confrontation within a movement on some specific issue, then that issue must be faced and all the things that flow from it, all the ideas which are consequential, are somehow raised. And in the last decade in our movement, the issue has been whether or not the rabbis should participate in intermarriages. A narrow issue, small, in terms of the real concerns of our age, inconsequential. But all the issues are there. Doesn't a rabbi exist to serve his congregation? And rabbis are discovering that there's a price to be paid for decades of having told to congregants, members, their communities, that in fact ritual issues, matters of observance are flexible. There are really no fixed standards. We need to find the ways which fit our day, and if we want to move ceremony from one place in the service to another, from one day in the calendar to another, there's no difference. And somehow, as this long, lingering debate has raged among us, a debate trivial, obviously, in terms of the detente, in terms of the Middle East, in terms of all the issues of true consequence, a number of us, and I think all of us, have taken a good hard look at this entity which we call Reform Judaism or Liberal Judaism, and we've tried to understand what in fact are the principles which we will not bend, which are inflexible. What authority do we accept? What are the organizing principles about which our congregations build this curriculum of the school and the worship of the service and around which those who occupy the pulpit build their teaching role? When Reform Judaism came into being in the early 19th century, those who were our founding fathers held what was essentially a double faith theory. The term I borrow from a term which was developed by Dr. Harry Ostrom Wolfson to explain the way in which medieval thinkers bound together the world of reason and the world of revelation. I use it in a 19th century way to describe the concerns of our founding fathers with the values of the liberal Western secular tradition and the values of our religious tradition. They assumed that these values were coherent, that in fact the world and the Jewish world were moving in the same directions, that these ideas could be wedded together without too much conflict. The basic themes of the West, of world civilization as they assumed it to be, and the basic themes of the Jewish continuum, they believed to be one and the same. There could not be real conflict. And so we could be creatures of two worlds, have a double faith, a faith which built the secular and the religious together into a truly happy and endlessly happy marriage. After all, didn't the Western world teach that all men are created equal, that there's certain inalienable rights, there's such a thing as reverence for life and for human dignity? Wasn't the Western world increasingly concerned with reason as opposed to the old feudal medieval world? Wasn't it devoted to social reform? Wasn't there concern with the development of a concept of humanity, of seeing the imprint of God, of divinity in everyone, those who were of the elite and those who had traditionally been outside the pale of society? Wasn't there every reason to believe in the early 19th century and throughout that century that we could live easily, without stress, within these two worlds of faith? And we could cite the psukim that they sought, they tended to cite, "Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us all? Establish justice in the gate, proclaim freedom unto the land, holy shalt thou be." These were the texts by which they bridged these two worlds, and they stood firmly, they believed, within two conflicting worlds. I call them conflicting worlds because as the 19th century turned into the 20th century, we began to discover that Western civilization, or world civilization, it was slowly becoming, was not, in fact, devoted solely to reason or to human brotherhood or to social reform. Freud taught us about passion and emotion and the irrational. There began to develop in the Western world theories of economic determinism and materialism, which emphasized the state and not the emergence of human freedoms. There was a pullback from emancipation. There was a recognition of the irrational in human behavior. Perhaps, in fact, there were assumptions about philosophy. It was now existential rather than unchanging, devoted to the needs of the moment rather than to certain changeless values. Morality was no longer seen as a fixed thing with certain basic constants to it. As the 20th century has emerged, most of us have become confused as to whether, in fact, we can stand in these two worlds. We're confused as to what, in fact, are the values of the larger world, and as we've studied our own tradition, come to know more and more about it. We know that those values which our fathers believed to be essential, the essence of Judaism, were only part of Judaism. Judaism was not simply this worldly, it was otherworldly. It did not simply affirm life, there were elements that were ascetic which denied life. It was not simply rational, there were elements within it which were mystical and Kabbalistic. And we became confused. We were still Jews, we still organized ourselves into synagogues, but we were not really certain as to what were the founding principles, what was the clear line along which we wanted to develop to guide ourselves. And more as we looked out at our movement, we saw the fabric of the liberal Jewish tradition becoming frayed and beginning to unravel. We looked at the fringes of our movement and we saw small groups of people coming together there, arguing that in fact the millennial watchword, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one," is not essential. That one could have a synagogue and be within the liberal tradition and have that synagogue devoted to a kind of humanism, an active denial of God. We looked within those who were thinking about liberal theology, and we found a number of them who were trying to make an active disjunct between Reformed Jews and all other Jews, between the tradition and the existential situation, people who tried to define Judaism in terms of simply of a radical openness to the future, claimed that history and tradition made no claim upon us. And if we look from those who try to think about or to create new forms which violated age-old traditions, and looked at some of the symptoms which began to emerge within the heart of the movement itself, we began to have questions. We found the Union of American Hebrew Congregations encouraging the establishment of a congregation of homosexuals despite the age-old tradition that we are not to hold up this kind of behavior as morally acceptable. Now, all of these are symptoms and not the issue. The issue is whether or not we have a movement or hefkerut, whether there are certain basic principles which we as Jews accept, by which we organize our lives, which we will not violate except in the conscious knowledge that we are sinning, or whether Reformed Judaism is simply a label which describes a group of people who happen by heredity to be Jews, who like to be with others who bear the label Jews, but who are capable of teaching, doing anything which fits the need of the moment. What are those principles which are intrinsically, basically, irrevocably Jewish, which we cannot go back on? What are the rituals? What are the observances? What are the practices which we as a synagogue, as a liberal Jewish synagogue, must not violate, must not shunt aside, must not exchange for so-called creative new activities? What is there Jewish about our person, about our soul? What is there Jewish about our homes? What is there Jewish in our social stance? Or is what we call social action simply a reflection of the modest liberalism of the middle class of whom we are a part here in America? Now, out of this debate over a very parochial issue, the question of rabbis officiating at intermarriages, all of these larger issues began to surface. And about 3 years ago, the Central Conference of American Rabbis asked me to organize a task force on Jewish identity, a group of men who would come together and who would begin to consider this question of authority, of authenticity, of definition, and who would try to raise up the very significant group of challenges, of ideas which have to be faced. And as we began to undertake our work, we found that it was rather easy to define the liberal Jewish community in America sociologically. We're white, we're middle class or upper middle class. We're suburban largely, except in a few very large suburban areas. We tend to be mildly liberal in our politics. We tend to be avidly cultural in our aesthetic interests. But beyond that, when we try to find a complete, easy definition of the Reformed Jewish community in religious terms, we found ourselves facing a very difficult task. Two out of three of our families make annual contributions to the United Jewish Appeal, and one out of three does not. One out of two of those who belong, adults who belong to our congregations, attend on both of the high holidays. One out of two does not. About 5% of our congregational membership have a pattern of rather regular public worship. 95 out of every 100 do not. If you look at the library of our congregations, you find a small percentage, we haven't measured it, who check out our books and do what we call Torah. And the larger group within our congregation do not read within the Jewish sphere of interest. How shall we define, then, those things which are of concern to us, which are essential, which we define as Jewish, as Torah, as mitzvot, that we must to be true to our convictions, we must follow and practice? Now, any good physician, before he begins to prescribe, will make sure he's given a full physical. You understand exactly, you know, what you're dealing with. And I know from this congregation, as I suspect most of you know from your own, that there is, in fact, a dedication to certain core disciplines and core values. There is concern for God and for Torah and for Israel. And you found as you've traveled around that most congregations tend to, at least publicly, express some of these concerns. In order to understand where we were, about 2 years ago, I undertook a study of how confirmation was observed in our movement in May of 1975. I wrote to any number of men who were kind enough to send me their order of service, their liturgy, the speeches which the class had given, any cantata which had been produced, the music which had been sung, the words which had been spoken by the rabbi or any member of the board, usually a president who'd been part of the service. In other words, the entire structure of the day. And I tried to analyze Confirmation 1975 in terms of what it said about our movement, because after all, Confirmation is a rite of passage. It's a day where we highlight certain themes, the themes that we want these young people, a class, to assume represent what is Jewish, what is Jewish to us, what is demanded of us. And I found some interesting things. I found, in the first instance, great variety even as to the date of confirmation. A number of congregations held it on Shavuot, a number of congregations on Erev Shavuot, a number of congregations on the following Friday night, a number of congregations on the following Sunday morning, a number of congregations the following Sunday afternoon. I found even one congregation which held confirmation at midnight of the confirmation class weekend. The rabbi wasn't able to remember the exact date. Now, I wasn't looking for calendar, I was looking for content. But I've come through these concerns of ours more and more to the conclusion that calendar, prayer book, consistency have a very important value in defining the context of a movement. I'm more and more convinced that some of the concerns which we lavish on being creative, on worshiping the new, are misplaced. Because we're making it more and more difficult for any of us to move from our home base around the country and find ourselves in essentially familiar surroundings, familiar worship, familiar song, familiar liturgy. But putting that aside, I found through this study that about 10% of our congregations had a confirmation which was either consciously or unconsciously devoted to the greater glory of a religion which I call the religion of high-minded vagueness. One such congregation had no pledge. The class made no affirmation of faith. There was a very brief service, which was followed by a series of speeches on the general theme of contributions to world peace. One youngster spoke warmly of the United Nations, another of UNESCO, another of UNICEF, another of the World Federalists. One even spoke on the European economic market. Now, these speeches in content and substance were not at all unlike the themes I would presume should be produced for a 10th grade civics class in the local high school. There was nothing traditional about them. Worse, there was no attempt to come to grips with the existential concerns of the Jewish community with these international bodies. There was not a word about the attempt within the United Nations to delegitimize the state of Israel, the savage attack in the world bodies by the third world, the Arab world, and the communist world against Israel. And as you could imagine, there was in this service not a word about Jewish history, about Soviet Jewry, about Syrian Jewry, about the American Jewish community, or Israel. There was just the worship of what I call the religion of high-minded vagueness. There was another service, which was held on a Sunday afternoon. Again, there was a very brief service. There was no class pledge. There was no confirmation of faith. There was no songs, either Israeli or UAHC camp. The only song I found in the service beyond some 19th century synagogue music was the song from Pippin, which is called Morning Song. Now, what it has to do with our Jewish continuum, I'm not sure, but that's what the class sang. And the service began with one youngster in the class making a contribution to world hunger. He said that the class wanted to devote its class fund to the cause of world hunger, certainly a laudable undertaking. But the terms in which this contribution were made were fascinating. It was made as a show to the congregation, that is to their parents and to their grandparents, that they ought not to be involved, and these are the words, they ought not to be involved with the concerns of the congregation or the concerns of the Jewish community, but with the larger concerns of mankind. And as you can imagine, the other speeches which followed from this all dealt with these kinds of cosmic issues. There was no attempt to define the realistic issues of modern Jewish life. And fascinatingly, when they came to Torah, they defined Torah as absolute freedom. And they took the old Midrash, that's the Torah was created before the creation of the world, that God looked into the Torah in order to create the world, and they turned it this way. The Torah was created before the creation of the world in order that no people might claim the Torah as their own. There is nothing intrinsically Jewish. Now, these horror stories represent, what, 10% of the services which I examined. No more, certainly, perhaps less. 90% of our movement in these confirmation services showed up as what I call members of the both-and school. Both internal, domestic Jewish concerns, both the private, devotional concerns of Jewish life, and the universalist concerns, the concerns of social action, the concerns of the center city of world peace, and so on. And I wanted to know whether or not this held true throughout the year. And I've just completed a study of Rosh Hashanah night, 1976. The Task Force on Jewish Identity is going to hold a conference in New York tomorrow and the next day, and I'm going to present this study there as a paper. But to be brief, I discovered that this 90%-10% ratio holds. That in about 10% of our congregations, there was a deliberate attempt to create a denatured religious posture, where the concerns are always defined as outer-directed, where the old mission rhetoric, where the is in full cry. There is nothing basically Jewish except a kind of social righteousness. And the Jews' basic and only real concern is to go out and, by example, to transform the community. But 90% of our congregations, clearly, on Rosh Hashanah night as on confirmation, try to find some way to wed together the prophetic and the priestly, the concerns of Israel and the concerns of mankind. What I also found, and I'm jumping now to my conclusion, what I also found was that most of our congregations find it awkward to talk about, to create liturgy, to create religious moments, to create a religious school curriculum which, in fact, effectively expresses this both-and position. We are still, unfortunately, very much the children of the rhetoric of the 19th century. And that rhetoric is passé, and it's outdated, and it's phony as far as it relates to our lives. Our fathers were fine men, and they created some great institutions. But their theology was naive, to say the least. Let me try and explain that to you. In the 19th century, men believed in progress, social evolution, that it was only a matter of time before everybody in the world was going to be like the Western middle class, decent, organized into families, concerned with manners, a member of the Brotherhood of Men of Goodwill. If Reform Judaism had any organizing principle, it was the doctrine of the Messianic Age, which meant to Isaac Meir Wise, the men like him, that it was only a matter of a generation, no more, before the world brotherhood would emerge into full flower, before the ideals of the West would permeate all corners of the world, before sweet reason, civic progress, and social democracy would become the norms of human life. They believed that. There was change, there was growth. Every day and every way, our world was getting better and better. And so the mission of Israel, as defined in that century until very late in our century, unfortunately, was not to come to the congregations and to engage in devotion. It was not to study Torah in any classic meaning of that word. It was to create institutions in the community of social reform, the community chest, social agencies of concern, to involve yourself in all, institutions, causes, and crusades which made for the betterment of mankind. Oh Lord, I pray that you will give me the strength to change the world. I found that amazing prayer in one of the confirmation services. I found it again as a conclusion to a rabbi's sermon in Rosh Hashanah 1976. Give me the strength, the understanding, the judgment to change the world. What chutzpah? Who of us is going to change the world? Who of us can really change himself? But as a movement, we had this messianic impatience, the sense of optimism, the sense of confidence. And then came Kishinev. And then came Stalin. And then came Treblinka, Dachau, Nuremberg. And then came 1948 and 1956 and 1967 and 1973, Yichad. And Israel became for almost all of us a type, a symbol of an imperfect world, of a world where there may in fact not be progress but retrogression, of a world of violence, of a world which by goodwill we cannot change, of a world where there must be prudential concerns with personal survival and the survival of one's own community, where we cannot let down all of the fences. With this new world, there came the need to redefine, to broaden, to bring back the millennial tensions of Jewish thought. Our age is tragic and burdened with a sense of tragedy. It's not optimistic, burdened with a sense of hope. Clearly, in our age, we're not going to transform the world. We can't believe, as did our fathers, that social democracy is the inevitable government of all countries in the future. Tyranny is on the upswing. We can't believe that reason will sweep over the world. We've lived to see too much cruelty in the feast of unreason. We can't believe that mankind has the capacity to transform itself. All that we know, it has the capacity to destroy itself. And so, as we face our problems, with all of the intellectual assumptions that go into any liberal posture that we will not accept tradition simply because it is traditional, we will try and understand the long thrust of our Jewish tradition. It's clear to me, at least, that just as the challenge in the 19th century was the challenge of change, the challenge of the 20th century is to find the changeless, the unchanging, the things that we cannot let go of. And the challenge for our congregations, it seems to me, is the challenge of definition, to create worship, study, school curriculum, a structure of definable, visibly definable observances, which will proclaim our Jewishness and what Jewishness is all about. Clearly, we can no longer get our values from the outside world, because the outside world is confused as to value. That's where the Hefkerut is. Every kind of cause is being huckstered at us from the outside world as new, as modern, as sophisticated, as cosmopolitan. And if we're going to find those few very basic themes about human dignity, about the mind and the heart, about family, about community, about social concern, about learning, about which our tradition has always revolved, we're going to have to turn within and learn and study, and no longer define ourselves in any way purely by what we get from the outside world, but what comes at us from within the deep wellsprings of our own tradition. And it's not going to be easy, because we have among us 10%, perhaps more, who believe that Judaism is whatever they want it to be. And we're not used in our pulpits or in our classrooms to declare certain things righteous and other things sinful, unless they're very broad social ethical kinds of concerns. And we've never really looked at the way in which the Jewish tradition has developed. One of the things I found fascinating, in the cantatas that were used at confirmation, there was a great evocation of the heroism of the Bible. And from the end of biblical times to modern times, the long rabbinic tradition was seen entirely as a midnight of oppression and of suffering, of martyrdom. But there has been very little attempt in our movement to understand the halachic way, to understand how by casuistry, by looking at every situation and applying to it all the moral concerns which ought to be applied, we can evolve some kind of understanding of what must be done in a particular situation. What we had were platitudes, these great sweeping statements which mask really lack of thought. I love the word peace, but I've heard Hitler use peace. I've heard Stalin use the word. I've heard Nasser use the word. I've heard Khrushchev use the word. And the word is no more significant in our mouths than in them, unless we mean certain specific things in a certain specific context. It's a matter of context that we have to come to grips with. Our heart, dear friends, I discovered through these studies, is in the right place. but we haven't gotten our minds there yet. And that's the challenge that I'd like to leave with you this morning. We here at the temple, and you and your congregations, to move away from the concerns of building and of the very real concerns, to ask yourself what it is we're really trying to do. What are the values around which you are really organized? Are you simply an adjunct of the ADA or the ACLU, or are you an adjunct of Amos and Hillel and Akiba and all those who were concerned with social action throughout the long centuries? There's a difference. There's a difference. Are you devoted to Torah as a kind of abstract statement? I use the public library. I read what's on the bestseller list. Or are you concerned with understanding the development, the evolution of our religious tradition, the thrust which makes us what we are? It's not a few platitudes. It's a very complex, paradoxical, tension-filled intellectual discipline. And can we some way communicate this to our children, to ourselves? And can we let this new insight, as we develop it, because it's going to be slow of growth, permeate all of our congregation, so that we ourselves will never raise again the question, what do we stand for? Do we stand for anything? I believe we do. But I also believe that we're going to have to spend much more time and effort than we have till now defining it, being precise about it, and clear about it. Amen.